It is time now for Health Writers on the Air.
So my name is José Bové. Listen to Health Writers if you are concerned about the health of the body politic.
This is health writer Rob Lewis. This week's program focuses on the neglected issue of poverty. This program features an interview I had with Kita and Monica, two very passionate and conscious women who are involved with Take Back the Land. Take Back the Land is a group which works to put people in homes. Kita also works for Freedom Inc., an organization which helps lower-income people of color here in Madison. In our conversation, we delved into the politics surrounding poverty and talked about Take Back the Land's approach to solving homelessness and poverty's root causes. How does Take Back the Land try to work on helping people who are experiencing poverty? What is the task of Take Back the Land?
So the movement goal, or the objective of the movement, is to achieve community control over land, and housing being a part of that. But it's a movement about community control over land that elevates housing as a human right. So what that means, I guess kind of theoretically, if we were to think about what does that mean or what is the implications of that in terms of poverty or ending poverty, in this country, wealth is built off of land, off of exploited labor of African folks on land, of the genocide of indigenous people, of taking land, of selling land, of people having to pay to be on land. So if Take Back the Land, when Take Back the Land is successful in achieving community control over land, that will fundamentally shift, that will fundamentally alter the way that wealth is thought about in this country and hopefully in the world. And so the way I would like to frame it is that it's a movement that addresses the root cause of poverty, the root cause of a lot of other systemic oppressions that happen.
So you're trying, it seems less of a legal battle and more of just physically getting people into homes, onto land, so that they can have greater stability, you know, a better quality of life. Is that correct?
Yes, we talk about the work as being a moral issue because we think that a lot of laws that currently exist are immoral. We think, for example, that the function of a house or a home should be to house people and not to be profit centers for banks. And so if those be the law, then we say that that law is immoral. Similar to how 50 years ago when black people went and sat in spaces that said white only, there were laws, actual laws on the rule books that said this was legal. But like they knew then, as we know now, that that was the immoral thing to do. That was, we like to think about our work as being moral versus whether or not it's legal.
Sure. So I was wondering if you two could talk about how you got involved. Kita?
Well, I was kind of dragged into the work, or fell into it by accident. I always knew there was something wrong. Like, I always knew, like, that poor communities were suffering, and, like, you really can't figure out why. It seems like it's only just you. And when I came to Madison, I was able to really see, like, the gap between how people live here and how people live, like, where I'm from in Milwaukee. Like, so I thought it was ridiculous. I started coming to meetings. I started to become more involved.
So I've been organizing for some time now, and I'm really interested in building and being a part of a movement that addresses the root causes of an issue. Because it makes no sense to simply put on another Band-Aid if you don't really deal with the problem. And so there was a local group here called Operation Welcome Home, which is a group of homeless folks and their allies. And their mission is to end homelessness. And they took kind of the route of Operation Welcome Home was to try to see what could be changed through legal channels. So what could be changed, you know, during petitions and protests and pickets and other things like that, or meetings with the mayor or what have you. And there were a group of folks who were like, that's good, that needs to happen. And so, and there also needs to be a really radical approach to doing this thing. Because in the meantime, whether or not the mayor decides to change his mind, people are still homeless, people are still dying, people are still without land or disconnected from land. And so a group of folks were like, what's out there, what's existing? And that's how we found out about Take Back the Land, the national movement, if you will, what's really called a translocal movement. But that's how we found out about other Take Back the Land around the country and kind of their objectives and how they were doing the work. And so folks got involved. And that very, like, direct action-oriented work and that very we're going to save ourselves type of work was very attractive to me. And it does address the root cause of many issues. And so I got involved.
And I was doing some research, and I saw that it's also inspired by the landless movement in Brazil. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so MST is the movement in Brazil where a large number of people were taking back large amount of agrarian land. And so we saw it, you know, it was like, this is great. You know, how can we do this? And then also, not only did it happen in Brazil with the MST movement, but then there was also the anti-eviction campaign, which was happening in South Africa, who learned a lot about the work that was being done in Brazil. And so we were looking at both of these and saying, like, you know, look, what would that look like here in the United States? What would it look like being led by people most affected, which tends to be low-income women of color, low-income genderqueer people of color? What would that look like here in the United States? And trying to take out some of the best practices and lessons learned from both places and trying to put that in effect here.
I was wondering if you could talk a little more about the situation in Madison with what people are going through and how, you know, Take Back the Land really addresses their needs.
So, a couple of reasons. So one, there's a good amount of people who are homeless here, who have never owned a home, who whose communities have been historically oppressed. So they were never came from a line of, for example, homeowners or different things like that. So there's a good amount of people like that here. And so kind of the most immediate thing is that Take Back the Land, the movement, provides a solution for people's lives now. So I think that's a big piece of it. And so something that I think is key in organizing is to win real improvements in people's lives. It makes no sense to go to the Capitol and to get some policy that never changes your life. You get 100 policies and tomorrow your life will still be the same. It makes no sense. So it actually can win a real improvement in people's lives immediately. And then also, it's led by the people who are most affected. So people who have these experiences are having some sort of self-determination. People who are having these experiences are saying, look, we're not going to take this anymore. We deserve better as people. It is our human right to have housing and to have land. And so they're taking charge of themselves and they're doing the work. And so why I think that's particularly important here in Madison is because Madison often gets talked about as this really progressive place to live in, is, oh, Madison is so great, it has all of these resources, all of these different programs, you know, and people reference some student work that has happened, some student mobilizations that have happened here in the past, and though all of those things can be true, like including the mobilization that's happened around Scott Walker, so all of that being true, it still doesn't talk about how Madison is also very oppressive when it comes to low-income communities of color and a lot of other groups, people with disabilities, so on and so forth. And so it prioritizes the agenda of folks who are disenfranchised. It prioritizes the agenda of the people who are continuously left out. Mm-hmm. It prioritizes the agenda of the people who never get talked about when Madison is talked about as being progressive.
So it takes people who a person who has a need for something and, you know, gets them into a house which is available. I was wondering if you could give an example of a campaign or a recent action. I've heard, but I haven't been able to attend any of them. Could you maybe talk about how your actions actually work and maybe the people that are involved?
Okay. So we work with, like I said, it's the people who are most impacted. So we work with a lot of homeless people. So in that sense, we have a natural base. So it isn't, so people we have relationships with, we do work with, are the people who say, hey, I want a house, right? So that's kind of how we find out who's going to be moved in the house, so to speak. It's a very natural process, because we already have these relationships and connections. And so a family, you know, who needs a house, I'll give you an example. There was a woman last May, her name was Desiree. She and her two children needed a home. They were homeless. And she was like, hey, I want this house. And so Take Back the Land identified a property that was owned by a bank that received federal bailout money. And in this particular case, it was Fannie Mae, the technical owner or whatever of the house at the time. And so what we did, Take Back the Land went to the house. The house was open. It was torn up. There was broken windows. The door was kicked in. There was all types of dirty things in the house. There was mold beginning to happen. So the house was in pretty bad condition. Nobody was maintaining the lawn. It just wasn't a good situation for anybody. It was an empty, abandoned house, which could have been really problematic for the community. And so Take Back the Land, identify the house, went into the house and began to clean up the house, so repairing pipes, getting rid of mold, replacing windows.
And who does those things?
Take Back the Land.
So all the members?
Some members, you know.
And do you get help from allies, or is it mostly the members that are doing these things?
It's like we have ally support. There's also ally support. And so Take Back the Land cleans up this property, prepares it, fixes it up, and moves the family into the house. And so Desiree lived there for a few weeks until the neighbor, one of the neighbors, who I guess found it problematic that she was there, called the authorities, called the police. And the police came and basically got the bank to file a complaint about her being there, because you can't kick someone out for trespassing without a formal complaint. Yeah, and that whole process was not very clear. And so she stayed in the house for some time, and then she eventually moved out.
So I'm wondering about your kind of immediate goals, what you're working on right now. I know the policy changes about, you know, the way banks should treat people, and how talking about having abandoned homes sold to the community, a nonprofit. I was wondering where that's at with your immediate work and your immediate goals.
So Take Back the Land, the movement itself, does not do negotiations work.
Yeah, we don't want to buy the homes.
Yeah.
We're not interested in purchasing them. They're already ours because you received bailout money, our tax dollars, so it belongs to the community already.
That's right. So the movement itself doesn't do negotiations work. There's strategic partners who engage in that kind of work. And so the local strategic partner here is Operation Welcome Home. Whereas if, you know, Take Back the Land was able to get the bank to say, okay, you know, we're tired of fighting you, here, take this property, Operation Welcome Home would then step in and say, okay, what can be negotiated? How will we work? Or what kind of policy change could come out of this? And so some of the things that could come out of policy work is there's been talk, and looking at other places in the country around blight ordinances, which is basically, you know, the bank gets fined after having a property be vacant for so long. And also kind of what you were talking about is one of the intermediate steps that Operation Welcome Home is trying to negotiate is that when a piece of property is won, who takes over that property, so to speak, who then becomes the group that manages that. And so they're working with the Madison Community Land Trust to get it out of the hands of banks and into the hands of the land trust. And I'll also be clear that that's an intermediate step. That is not the ultimate step. The ultimate goal is community control over land, so it would be in 50 years from now, it would be the land trust. What that alternative is, I'm not quite sure of what that looks like at the time, but right now the current alternative and the much better alternative is the land trust.
That's very interesting. So it's not really personal ownership that you're talking about. You're talking about
community,
collective ownership and access, really, is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, and we don't like to talk about ownership because we don't believe that any of us can own the land. And if any group was to own the land, it would be the First Nation and Indigenous people. So we talk about local community control And yes, it would be decided upon by the people who are there to be able to talk about what should happen here. If they thought it should be a house here or a school here or a playground or whatever the case may be. But for local community control over the land, whether it be used for housing or whether it be used to grow food.
So, you know, poverty really isn't something that's talked about very much. That's really a problem. What would you like listeners to understand about poverty that you think they might be missing?
So, well, the hard truth of the matter is, I think, even in this very quote-unquote progressive place, a lot of people have very weak class analysis. It's very weak. And I think what people have to understand is that poverty exists because of the exploitation and the genocide of groups of people. And so poverty is a structural and a systemic issue. And in order to change it, in order to defeat it, it's going to take some sort of science. And it is absolutely going to take systemic and structural change. And I think that's what people miss. I think people would like to believe that, you know, poverty will be ended if everybody could just get up and go to work one day. Or people would like to think that people are poor because they're lazy or because they're stupid or whatever kind of foul and untrue.
So you're talking about the problem is the way society works.
Yes. poverty is, if you have a capitalistic society, there will be poverty, period. And I think a lot of people don't want to get behind that. I think a lot of people don't. And that matters for a lot of reasons. Because there's a lot of middle class to well-to-do people here. And to end poverty means that we have to restructure what we know as wealth. We have to restructure the way things are split up or divvied out. And we have to restructure who gets control over what land. And that means a lot of people are going to have to give things up.
So I think
people aren't willing to do that.
So how are people generally in society who aren't experiencing the same poverty, how are they affected? Why should they care?
Well, for a couple reasons. One, we're saying that with Scott Walker, capitalism itself, I don't think is very stable. Right. And we see that with the threatening of the middle class. And to me, that should be a huge indicator that what's currently happening does not make sense.
Can happen to anyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the reason why we're able to take back the land the way we are able to do it right now and have is because we have a political opening of white middle class people being affected by housing laws. Right. And so I think we're clearly seeing that whatever way that people thought was good to do things, whatever way people thought were comfortable, is unstable, and it's going to require the exploitation of a group of people. For a very long time, that has been African folks in this country. It has been indigenous people. It has been a lot of other groups of color. It has been women folks. It has been, like, marginalized groups who were bearing the cost of that. But now it's happening to groups who were once power groups. And so we're seeing that that it's not working. And so I think, what do they have? Why should they care? Because it's a matter of time before it's them, is the hard truth of the matter. It is a matter of time within the capitalist society that the middle class will be drastically impacted by capitalism.
Just to continue, you know, you guys are leading the way in what seems to me to be a revolutionary movement about really changing society in a fundamental way. Would you agree?
This is a people's movement. It's about the rights of people. I guess the truth of the matter is, when you talk about human rights, that makes you really radical. That makes you really revolutionary.
What ideas guide you in your work, like your personal motivation, but then also we've talked a little bit about your political perspective?
Well, I just see me in the community. I see my family. When I see homeless people, I could see like how easily that could be my brother, how easily that could be me if I miss a check. So I just think of it as if everybody is me. And what would I want to happen and what would I want done? So that's the way that I do my work. And politically, I just feel like people shouldn't have to pay for things that they need to live, because it's saying that this dollar is more important than I am. And that's ludicrous.
Che Guevara says that the true revolutionary is guided through feelings of love. And I think that's true. You do it because you love the people. And look, if people are getting involved in this work because they think it's going to be a great payout, you're going to sell some good book, you're in the wrong, you know. So you really, and it's hard. It is hard.
So you're doing it for yourself, too.
Yeah, I'm doing it for me and for the people, right? And so you do it because you do it.
Money.
Yeah, you do it because you love the people. A good friend of mine, Max Rameau, says, who's part of the Take Back the Land movement, he says, you owe it to your ancestors to further the movement, right?
Yeah.
So I do it for me, and I do it for my grandchildren who are yet to come, but I also do it for my grandmother, and I also do it for her grandmother, right? So you do it for the people because it's hard, you know, and if there's not a lot of love there, it's easy
to fall out of touch with the movement. It's easy to become overwhelmed and to give up. It's hard to keep fighting.
Or to lose.
So you gotta really, really wanna do it.
And if it's gonna be a movement, it needs to be of the people, by the people, for the people. Mm-hmm. So you always need to be connected with the people. I do nobody any good if all I do is read books all day and write papers. I haven't changed anything.
So poverty disproportionately affects people of color, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering how racism plays a role in all of this.
Yeah. There's no way to talk about class in this country without talking about race, period. There's no way to do it. And racism is a huge, huge factor. So race is going to be often, I think, a determining factor of how the struggle is perceived and how the movement is perceived. And so I think that makes our work really difficult here in Madison when it's black people, when it's brown people, black people, poor people out there talking about land versus when there's a white middle class homeowner who just loses their house to foreclosure. That's received very differently. And so race definitely is a major part of the narrative that takes place. It's not talked about in a very visible way. It's not dissected and unpackaged in a very visible way. But it's definitely a part of the mainstream narrative, which drives a lot of the things that happen. Madison has huge racial problems. Madison is talked about as this really great city, but we're also the highest in the country for disproportionate minority confinement. We're also one of the worst education systems in the country for black youth. We're also one of the worst in terms of wealth or financial security of black people in the country. So Madison is very good for white people, but terrible for black people and a lot of other people of color.
So do you think overcoming, you know, that divide would really help the movement a lot?
Yeah.
Is that something that holds back the movement?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Yes, because of people's ignorance, because of people's racism, they're not able to really take the blinders off, so to speak, to see what's really happening. And I think, you know, a lot of people grew up with the narrative that, oh, all black people are lazy, and that's where they're poor, and that's where they're homeless, right? And that's definitely a function of racism and also classism. And because of that makes things divisive. But at the same time, it also does not hold back the movement, because the movement will happen whether or not those people choose to join. You know, my liberation can't be tied to whether or not somebody decides to like me tomorrow. It never has been and never will be, right? During the civil rights movement, they didn't win because white people decided to like black people the same. No, it was never the case. And so that's also going to be true here. It would be great if all white people liked all black people, but it, you know, whether or not that happens is not going to determine whether or not I'm liberated.
Let's see. How has the movement changed either, you know, in America or just in Madison? I guess maybe you could just focus on Madison, how your work has changed.
The principles of the movement are still the same, that, you know, it has to have direct action. It has to elevate housing as a human right. It has to be led by those most impacted. Those things are still true. What has happened, though, because of all the stuff with Scott Walker, is that we have begun to form some sort of alliance with people who we wouldn't have previously had those alliances with, because they too are impacted now by the housing foreclosures or by the legislation that's happening. So I think that's a significant difference between now and last May, for example. Whereas last May, we had little allies who occupied or who were part of mainstream, and whereas now we have some more who are part of mainstream but who now support it because they've been impacted. And I also think, you know, definitely another year of media attention to given to banks around banks doing really bad things has definitely helped us, him and I particularly. And so I think those things have really helped that the story is continuously told, and that's created space for there to be more allies, and then also with the current administration giving us another political opening to be able to do this work, so to speak.
And I have two questions. What is your greatest concern about, you know, the prospects for change? You know, what would stop us from succeeding? And what is your greatest hope that you are really hopeful about things changing and getting better?
Realistically, I don't think that I will see a change in my lifetime. But my greatest hope is that my grandkids...
Well, why don't you think you'll see a change?
It's a very slow process. Baby steps. Like, we're working really hard towards it, but it's a lot of stuff working against us. Like, the same... Just like we're out here organizing for it, there's are people who are out here organizing against it. So, you know, it's kind of like push and pull a little bit. And if things go the way that we need them to go for everything, for people not to have to pay for things they need to live, then people who are wealthy will have to give up some of their power or give up some of their wealth, and I see that as a struggle. I think that's going to be like pulling teeth.
What about you, Monica?
So, my hope is that we'll win. I mean, I do this thing because I think we can win. I'm not just doing it for the sake of doing it. I really do think we can win. When that win will happen, I don't know. I would love to wake up and that, it'd be tomorrow. I don't have a timeline, but I am hopeful that we will win. My concern is how long it might take. How will it happen? So there's kind of this, ongoing political debate, I think, or theoretical debate around whether or not you can achieve what you want to achieve, whether or not you can achieve a really radical outcome through a series of reforms, or does it have to be a revolution that takes to the streets? That remains to be seen. And then also, like, the sad, messy part of what will we have to sacrifice in order for it to happen? And that part is concerning, because so many of my people have died in movement. So many of my people have been beat and incarcerated and enslaved, you know what I mean? So just the concern is really like how much more of my folks gotta be killed, you know?
All right. Well, thanks for joining me in the studio, and we'll be trying to follow your work too.
Thank you.
If you want more information and to get involved with this avenue of change in your community, you can connect at Take Back the Land, Madison's website, tblmadison.wordpress.com. The National Movement website is takebacktheland.org. Monica can be reached at m@takebacktheland.org. Freedom Inc.'s website is aboutfreedominc.com, and they have an office to visit at 601 Bayview in Madison. Feel free to leave a note if no one is there.
Housing is here.